This is an oral history interview at Westminster School on the 3rd of October 2019 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist, and
Alan Borg.
Right, I wonder if we could start at the beginning, Alan, and you could tell me a little bit about your childhood before Westminster and your family.
My childhood before Westminster was we lived in Surrey near Epsom. I had an older brother who came to Westminster School as a Queen's Scholar, and he must have come, I came in 54, so he was 6 years older than me, and so he presumably came in 48. He was one of those who was present for the coronation, of course. I joined the school as a day boy, having been at a prep school called Downs End in Surrey. Although I was a day boy, I went up Busby's, which was, of course, a boarding house.
And why do you think your parents chose Westminster for your brother and yourself?
I think it was because my brother had been at the school. Interestingly, he was cleverer than I, and my father, or perhaps my school teachers at Downs End, decided that I wasn't up to taking the challenge. So I just took the common entrance and got in on that. But I'm sure it was because there's no previous connection with Westminster School before my brother. My ancestry, so to speak, is Swedish. So I wouldn't have gone to Westminster from Stockholm.
What did your parents do?
My father was initially a chartered accountant and then went into what was then called personnel management. Before the war, he worked for Siemens Electronics, who sent him to the United States. And he couldn't stand it and came back quite quickly because the temperature was so high and summer and so cold in winter. In fact, they weren't married at that point, was meant to go out and join him, and we would all have been born in the States, but he came back, and so we weren't.
And you sat the common entrance, was that at your prep school that you sat it, or did you come to...
I came to the school and sat, the exams took place up school.
And what are your earliest memories of the school's buildings? Did you see it before that point, when your brother was... people here?
I must have done, but I don't really remember it. What I remember primarily is I came in 54, and that was just as school was being redone. And so apart from sitting the entrance exam in school, I hardly went into it through my time here, and of course what we used was St. Margaret's as the school hall, and had Latin prayers and all that sort of thing in there.
I'd never heard that before. That's really interesting. So St. Margaret's, and you had to walk round, and were the Abbey accommodating?
Oh, the Abbey were accommodating, because in those days there were far fewer people, not the great crowds they are now. And yes, everything took place in St. Margaret's. The one thing I remember was, for some reason, it was decided or ordered that we weren't allowed to clap anything in the St. Margaret's. However, we were allowed to stamp on the floor, so that replaced clapping.
And when you first arrived in Busby's house, what were your first impressions of the house and the housemaster?
The first impressions, I can't really remember what my first impressions were. It all seemed rather strange, of course. It was very welcoming. I soon made some friends. The housemaster was Francis Rawls, known as Pinky, and he had been on Montgomery's staff during the war and acted as he, exactly as you would expect a member of Monty's staff. He was rather autocratic, but perfectly nice and fair, I thought.
Were you conscious of a lot of your schoolmaster's war service? Was it something that got talked about sometimes?
Not particularly, no. I mean, we knew that numbers of them had been serving in the war in various capacities, but they didn't talk about it, and so we didn't ask on the whole.
And was it a strange experience being in a house that had a boarding element but not being a boarder?
Well, again, because I had nothing to compare it with, it didn't seem particularly strange to me. There were one or two other day boarders in boarding houses, and I met them, and they equally seemed happy. One particularly, a man called Finneran, who I think was up Grants, came in and back on the same train that I did, so I saw him regularly.
And did you get involved in house activities? There were a lot of plays in Busby's.
I got involved in some of the house activities, particularly the choir, which was very active and was conducted by a Busbyite called, I think, McMenemy. I can't remember what his background was, but he was very active in Westminster music, not just in the school, in the house, but in the school. Sadly, he died quite young, so he went on to a great musical career.
And what about the school subjects? What did you enjoy most in your lessons?
The usual range of school subjects, some of which I was quite good at and some of which I was very bad at. I eventually became a historian, and I was always interested in history and English, and we had English was taught by a man called Lushington, who became famous in Westminster for being fired eventually. he was a very good teacher, all the teachers were good. I was not good at mathematics. I was hopeless at physics, which baffled me entirely, and I don't think was well taught. I quite enjoyed chemistry because there were lots of Bunsen burners and things.
Were you at the school at the point where the science labs were still in Little Dean's yard?
No, they were across the road in where the art department now is.
In Sutcliffe's, okay. And at what stage were you able to abandon those subjects that you weren't getting on with?
I think they were abandoned at whatever it was called, O-level, was it, in those days? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that then. Yes, it must have been then, because the only O-level I failed and didn't retake was physics.
And you mentioned Stephen Lushington and Francis Rawls. What about the headmaster at the time? Was he much of a presence?
Well, when I joined the school, the headmaster was Walter Hamilton, and with his great booming voice. But he was there for only, I think, 2 years, and I didn't have really anything to do with him. He was replaced by John Carlton, who had a much better people manner than Walter Hamilton had, and lessons with him were quite fun.
And what was a sort of normal day like? You'd come in on the train in the morning?
Depending on how energetic I was feeling, I would either walk or get a bus from Victoria Station up to the school. Being in there by, I guess, about, certainly by 9, but probably by 8:30. And then, of course, in those days, every day started with Abbey. So off to the Abbey. One of my fellow pupils who I got to know well was Richard Townend, who you may know has become his headmaster of this prep school his father founded in London now, but his main interest has always been music and playing the organ, and he's a distinguished organist. So he occasionally was allowed to play the Abbey organ at the morning services.
And lunch was in your house?
Lunch was in the house, yes. Yeah. I remember not very good food.
And was it served to you? Do you sort of...
No, what tended to happen was a large bowl of something would be presented and put in front of someone, probably a senior member of the house, who then ladled out portions to everyone.
And if the food wasn't very good, did you supplement it at all?
Oh, yes, certainly.
There was a school store at that point?
There was a school store. It didn't really sell food, however. Okay. It was for ties and all that sort of thing.
Okay, so you had to go further afield to get some snacks. And then, did the school day end with Latin prayers?
Sometimes Latin prayers in the afternoon. Yeah. I can't remember why, but it normally didn't end with Latin prayers. It ended after the last lesson,
mm-hmm.
And then you either went off and did, in my case, go home or attended one of the after school events, of which there were many.
Mm. And we talked about music and plays. I know that you were quite athletic at school too.
Yeah. I was quite athletic at school, partly as a way out of being unathletic at another sport. When I started, I played football, as everyone did, which involved the tedious journey down to Grove Park, and on sort of wet, cold winter afternoons, that was very tedious, and Grove Park itself was a pretty awful place. So I thought I must be something better than this, and I was always taken with the idea of fencing, which seemed to be a more romantic activity, and so I became a fencer. And in those days, the master in charge of fencing was, what was his first name, Sanger, and he had been a fencer, and he was very good and very cheerful. And when I joined, the fencing team was very good. And I'm glad to say, during my time, continued to be good.
Where did you do the fencing at school?
In the old gym.
So probably leaky roof.
Yes.
Sort of quite cold. And what about the sort of the school rituals? Do you have any sort of strong memories of the grease? Did the grease happen if you couldn't go up school that much? Or
the grease did happen, I think, towards the end of my time, because the school was shut for quite a lot of the time. But it certainly happened, and I remember attending it and watching, being rather pleased that I wasn't actually directly involved. But it was it's a good and ancient tradition.
Commemoration in the Abbey, is that?
Yes, it was. I remember going to one commem, but probably not more. It was more restricted, I think, in those days. It wasn't the sort of great event it is now. It's certainly not the big commem that we have.
Mm.
But of course, going into the Abbey was always one of the pleasures of being at the school. And since my later life, I was an architectural and art historian. I always say that going into the Abbey every day for 5 years is what made me do that, because if I got bored with the sermon or whatever, I would look at the building.
And did you get to move around? We at the moment, we very consciously move where the people sit from term to term, so they get to see different bits of the Abbey. Were you always sitting in the same place, or did
I
you...
think we were always in the same place, which was in the choir, and I don't think we moved around. The school was smaller then, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And we could all get in quite easily.
and the other traditions I was going to ask you about, I'm not sure whether you were you at all involved in the Latin plays?
No, I wasn't. My brother had been. He was a classicist and then went to university to read Sanskrit, surprisingly. But he was involved and I think took part in a Latin play at one point. But no, they rather passed me by.
And was the election dinner a feature for you at all, either?
I was aware it was taking place, and a notice would go up on the notice board in Busby's inviting anyone to submit epigrams. I don't think many people did.
No. And what was the discipline like within the house? When you started, did you have to fag for anybody?
No. Yes, I did, briefly. It wasn't in the least onerous. And I had to make toast for the head of the house or something, which left me rather resentful when I eventually got to be a senior member of Busby's fagging had been abolished. So I thought this was rather unfair.
And were you ever punished by the senior boys in the house, or conscious of other people being punished, or was that the preserve of the teachers?
I think it had being punished had largely phased out by that stage, and I certainly don't remember it.
And did you ever get into trouble?
Did I ever get into trouble? I suppose in minor ways, but nothing serious.
What about the matron? Did you have anything to? Do you ever get to see the matron in the house, that more of a boarding?
Yeah, that more of a boarding thing, I think.
And you mentioned that, you know, whilst you were there, the school was being reconstructed. Were you sort of conscious of that going on? Were there some builders around and?
Conscious of it going on in so far as you couldn't go up school, and not really conscious of the builders, but I suppose there were fewer places you could go to in the school than there are now, but it didn't really impinge on us particularly. But one thing was that, for example, in the summer we would abandon, if the weather was halfway decent, we would abandon fencing in the gym and just fence in yard, which was very nice.
And were you here when school was reopened, when the Queen visited?
I was here for the 1960 anniversary. That's not what you mean, is it?
Did she reopen at the anniversary? She's only visited in 1960, yeah. Didn't she? And I don't know whether it was a sort of almost slightly fake reopening of school, because presumably it had been
reopened, but I was certainly here for that visit, and I can tell you a nice story about it, because I was in the History 6 at that point, and we put on, largely with the help of the history masters, who were Charles Keeley and Roy Haynes, an exhibition in the library, the old library, about the history of Westminster and old Westminsters. And I was deputed, I'm never sure why, to take the Queen round this. So I worked very hard, learning everything I could about all the old Westminsters whose portraits we had on the walls. And she arrived and was very gracious, and I took her round. And we got about halfway round, and she stopped in front of, I can't remember, it may have been a Duke of Newcastle, and pointed at it and said, didn't he own a Derby winner? And this, of course, was the one thing that I had not checked up on. So I had to say, I'm very sorry, ma'am, I do not know. However, it gave me considerable pleasure many years later, at another meeting with the Queen, to be able to tell her, to remind her of this occasion, and tell her that, in fact, the individual in question had owned two Derby winners. I don't suppose she actually remembered it.
And those history teachers, did you enjoy the lessons with them? What, were you beginning to sort of have a strong sense of what you wanted to do after you left school?
Yes, to an extent, and they were both exceptional teachers. Roy Haynes, who left not long after I did and went to be a professor in Canada, I think, and only died a couple of years ago, at a great age, was a very good but sort of straight history teacher. Charles Keeley, as you may know, was quite different. He was an extraordinary man, incredibly shy. And his teaching was not really teaching at all. He used to come in, the History 6 had lessons in the library. We were all sitting around in armchairs and so on, and Keeley would come in and say something like, there's a rather interesting law report in the Times today, and read it out at full length to all of us. We had no idea what this, you know, what we were supposed to glean from this or what it was to do with history. Another occasion I remember, for a whole term, he read us the entire Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann. it was an extraordinary form of teaching, and he occasionally did get onto historical subjects, but he had the best and longest comments in red ink on your essays that I ever came across. He would get something, an essay back with a sentence underlined, and it would say, or say at the top, plus B, query, minus A, query, something else. It was an extraordinary code which he marked things in. But I think he taught people to be inquisitive and to be interested in the facts as they were presented and so on, and that ultimately was very useful.
Were your parents sort of a regular part of your school life? You know, were they in for parents' evenings? Were there lots of reports?
Reports, certainly. I don't, and they may have come to parents' evenings. I don't actually remember parents' evenings at all. But they were certainly interested, and they would come to the school for events and so on. Living a little way away, they probably were less assiduous in doing that than some others who lived in central London.
Mm. And you didn't overlap with your brother at all, did you?
I didn't overlap with my brother at all, no.
No.
He left, I think, in the year before I came.
Another person I wanted to ask you about was, I know that you got to know Lawrence Tanner.
Yes, I got to know Lawrence Tanner very well. He was a wonderful man. He, of course, had long since left the school. But when I left the school in 1960, and in the days before gap years in Thailand and so on, I was faced with about 9 months of not knowing what to do. And I can't remember who suggested it, whether he suggested it to me or I to him. He said it would be nice if I could come and work in the muniment room, because he was then keeper of the muniments. And I did that, and it was wonderful training. I was paid £10 a week. And for the first 4 or 5 weeks, he said, just go around the muniment room, find out what's where, pull out documents and see if you can read them. He taught me to read medieval hands reasonably well, and so on. He used to go round the abbey, I don't think it was quite every week, but maybe every fortnight, because he said, no one ever tells me what they've done in the abbey, and they're always moving things and so on. And I would accompany him on these visits. When I learned an enormous amount from him about the abbey, and his ability to remember was extraordinary, because he went right back to the beginning of the century. A really nice and valuable man. Tragedy was that he went blind, as we know. It's an awful thing for someone who spent their life with documents not to be able to read them at the end.
Was he alone in the muniment room at that stage, or were there anyone else?
Yes, there were various other people. There was a deputy keeper. What was his name? I can't remember. A small Scotsman. We were joined by a man called Alec B. Tonicky, who had just retired as a keeper in the Romano-British department, what it was called, at the British Museum. And Tonicky was one of the more interesting people that one could meet. He lived somewhere like Earl's Court, and he used to come into the muniment room every day on the underground, on the Circle Line, not very far, I suppose, from South Kent. And he would do the Times crossword, by which I mean he would do the Times crossword entirely from beginning to end in the few railway stops that were available to him. And there were occasional, serious occasions when he was late in, and that meant he hadn't finished the crossword. And because it was the Circle Line, he would stay on and go all the way around the Circle Line, finish the crossword, and then come in at about 10:30 or something, and there was one terrible day when he didn't come in until after lunch. But I think he'd still finished it on the third time round the circle. And he was writing, he had just written one of the more obscure works, which is entitled A Catalogue of Seal Dyes in the British Museum, Volume 1. No one has ever undertaken Volume 2.
Obviously, I guess there was at that stage perhaps more than just muniments, more than just records up in the muniment room too.
Yes.
Before there was...
Lots of records. So various scholars came in and studied them. One I remember was marvellous. I think I recognised she was a marvellous woman, though she'd never said anything, Barbara Harvey, who was entirely silent and worked away day in, day out on the Abbey documents and then produced this great book on the Abbey estates. So I just saw her and realised she was doing wonderful things. There was a Belgian, I think he was, called Pierre Chaplet, who was completely taken up with fake documents. And he used to work away in the moon and occasionally would rush in waving a charter saying, "I found another one." These were, of course, the forged charters of possessions, which the Abbey has quite a number of. Yes, other people would come in. It was in the Munich room that I had one of my great experiences, because in the few weeks that I had, the Tanner had said to go, just find out what's here. As you will know, if you go in through the door, there's a little spiral staircase up, and on that spiral staircase is a door, a cupboard. And I opened this cupboard, and it was very dark, there was no lighting there in those days, and felt around inside and felt something which felt like, and indeed was, a bone. And it was a very large bone, and it had on it a label tied on it, which I could already recognise as probably a late 17th century hand, and it said, "Thigh bone of King Edward I. So grabbing this, I went up to see Tanner and said, "I found this." This is what he said. And he said, "Oh, yes, that's right." They opened the tomb in whenever it was. And when they put him back, they forgot the thigh bone. So I put it back in the cupboard. And then, not all that long after that, I think the tomb was opened again and the thigh bone was returned. So I'm one of the last people to have held the thigh bone of Edward I.
And was this before there was any kind of museum at the Abbey?
It was before there was any kind of museum. The possessions of the museum were sort of strewn around, mostly in the moon room or various other parts. I was delighted, as a fencer, that the so-called sword of Henry V was just lying on top of one of the cabinets, and I used to pick it up and wave it around because it's a beautifully balanced sword. Of course, it's now treated with the respect it's no doubt due, although it probably isn't Henry V.
And so after this sort of wonderful 9 months, you went on to Oxford.
Yep.
What did you study at Oxford? Was it history?
History, yes. And I got into Oxford again, I'm quite sure due to Westminster, because I sat the then closed entrance exams both to Trinity and Christ Church, both of whom gave me a place. But then I, simply because I liked the name, I took exams for Brasenose College, and they gave me a scholarship. This was worth money, so my father quite rightly decided that was one to go for. So I went, but I'm quite sure I got directly through my experience at Westminster, because Charles Keeley used to set us each week for Saturday mornings, when we, of course, all came into Saturday school, sort of general paper topics, and there were always general papers in these exams. And the time I took it, for Brasenose College, we were asked to write an essay, and the two topics which we had to choose from were something like the current civil wars in Africa And the other one was virtuosity in art. And I took virtuosity in art. And when I came to my oral exam at Brasenose, going in, there was a line of serious-looking dons facing me across the table, and the chairman said, now, Borg, what general paper did you do? And I said, virtuosity in art. And he said, oh, thank God, means you can't have spelt Lumumba wrong. Lumumba being the president of whichever bit of the Congo was currently being fought over. And I'm quite sure that got me a scholarship.
Was Oxford, some people say that they felt it was a bit of a come down after Westminster, but how did you find it?
No, I didn't find it a come down. I found it, as I always did and have, a very sort of stimulating place, and lots of very bright people. And perhaps it's because when I went to Brasenose, it had a particular reputation as being a not very bright college, but full of sporty people.
Mm-hmm. And you carried on fencing.
I carried on fencing there. So. Fencing was an important part of my life then, because when I fenced at Westminster in 1956, there was the Hungarian uprising. And who or what in the school cottoned on to this, but one of the people who got out of Hungary in 56 was a man called Béla Imrégi, who was the world champion sabreur. And someone got him to come and teach sabre at Westminster. And he taught me through my time here. And then when I got to Oxford, he was still teaching, and he was a brilliant sabreur, and I learned a great deal from him. But also, when I was here at the school, when I first started fencing, the captain of fencing was Corin Redgrave. And Corin Redgrave, who obviously better known as an actor and his acting family, but Corin was the most beautiful fencer I have ever seen. He was absolutely natural. He moved impeccably and was a very, very good fencer, and could certainly have gone on to be in the England team and so on, but he went off to RADA or something instead. But then my precise contemporary was Nick Halstead from Grants. Nick was a very good and serious fencer, particularly with the épée. We went to Oxford together, and he then went on to take part in the Olympic Games, trying from Mexico, I think it was, and did quite well there too. So it was a good time to be. I know fencing has often been strong at Westminster, but it was certainly stronger in my day.
Did you keep in touch with a lot of friends from school in Oxford?
I kept in touch with a number of them, and still do. Mostly, perhaps more from Oxford than from Westminster. My good friend Nick Halstead, of course, sadly died of a brain tumour very young. But I have a number of good Westminster friends. Someone called Andrew Medlicott, whose younger brother was also at the school, was a good friend, and so on. Yes, the atmosphere of the school encouraged people to make friends, which was good.
And then you sort of began pursuing quite an academic career, of study and a PhD.
Yeah, I went from Brasenose to the. Well, I was going to go directly to the Courtauld Institute. But I was 48 hours before taking my finals. I was approached by someone who lived on my staircase, a very distinguished man called Robert Shackleton, who was Bodley's librarian at the time, who said, would you like to go to Aix-en-Provence for a year? My good friend Henri Flucher, who is the dean of the faculty at Aix, needs someone to go and teach there for a year. So I said, well, yes, it sounds wonderful, but I'm actually going to the Courtauld Institute. He said, well, can't you get in touch with the Courtauld and see if they'll postpone your entry? So I did. Sort of thing which wouldn't happen now. I phoned up the Courtauld Institute, and I had a query about my place for the following year, and was immediately put through to the director, who was, of course, Anthony Blunt. Anthony was very understanding about it, but I, in retrospect, I always remember him saying, I think it's probably a good thing for a young man always to spend some time abroad, which may have had a double meaning. But anyway, they happily postponed it, and so I went to X for a year, and then back to the Courtauld, where, and being in X, I picked up my dissertation project on Romanesque buildings in Provence. And then again, while I was at the Courtauld, there was a professor from Indiana University who was looking for someone to go to Indiana as a medievalist. And so I went there for nearly 3 years, and then I went to Princeton for just over a year and came back in 1970.
And were you thinking of becoming an academic?
I was thinking of becoming an academic, because when I came back in 1970, I'd been teaching for 4 or so years. I'd just published a book and various articles, and it was clear to me that I was God's gift to art history. And that British universities would be falling over themselves to employ me. And slightly to my surprise, they weren't, because all my colleagues who had stayed in the UK were better known than I was, people like Eric Fernie and so on. They got all the jobs. And I was unemployed only for about 9 months. And then one of my tutors at the Courtauld, George Zarnetsky, said, had I thought about the job which had just been opened up at the Tower of London in the Royal Armouries? And I said, no, I haven't thought about it, because I don't know anything about arms and armour. And he said, well, if you've been properly taught at the Courtauld, you'll pick it up quickly enough. And I applied and got in, but it transpired that George was a good friend of the then Master of the Armouries, Dick Dufty, so I think it was pulling strings that got me there. But it changed the whole course of my career, because I went from that traditional form of academia to museums, where specialising in anything is much more difficult. You have to be able to deal with whatever comes in, and which I think is a good thing.
Did the fencing help with the armoury?
Marginally.
And so, yes, from then on, you've had an incredibly successful career in museums. I'm sort of stumbling thinking about what to ask you about first, really. But I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about the Imperial War Museum and then about the V&A.
Well, the answer is that, like everyone, a lot of my life has depended on luck. And in going to the Imperial War Museum, I was very lucky. I went first from the Tower of London. I was the first director of something called the Sainsbury Centre for Visual Arts at the University of East Anglia, what was then a very unusual Foster building. I still think it's one of his best buildings. And then the post at the IWM was advertised. I applied for it, and they were clearly looking for someone to redo the museum, but also someone with a knowledge of military museums. And because I'd worked in the Tower, and because I'd set up the Sainsbury Centre, my face fitted. But the key thing was that I was interviewed for my job in 1982 on the day that the task force sailed to the Falklands. And I didn't realise the significance of that at the time, but I did when I was given the job and got into it. It was that Mrs. Thatcher had absolutely no interest in museums at all, except mine, because we were going to cover her war. And so throughout the 80s, when most of the national museums, in terms of financial settlements, did very badly, the Imperial War Museum did very well, and we got all the money to redo it and so on. So it was sort of thing you cannot possibly plan for.
Did you feel that there was any pressure about how you recorded Mrs. Thatcher's war?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But the IWM has always had, and I hope, I believe, still contains a strong element of looking objectively at war and warfare and the people involved in it. It's one of the, if you like, the attractions, if you can talk about attraction of war, is looking at the admirable things, personal bravery, personal actions that come out in from horrible circumstances. And that was a fascinating part of it. I was also, again, extraordinarily lucky in my timing, because in the 1980s, a very large number, a large number of people who had, well, both fought in the First, but particularly in the Second World War, and who were famous, people like Douglas Bader and Leonard Cheshire and so on, were not only still alive, but very lively, and they became good friends, which was a huge privilege.
And then on to the V&A.
Yep.
In due course.
Well, that was back to my roots, more so to speak, and the V&A is, as you know, is a fantastic museum, wonderful collections, unwieldy, very difficult to run, but a very enjoyable place to be.
Did you find the sheer breadth of their collections difficult to get a handle on?
Yes, because there are always probably whole collections, but certainly whole corners of collections which you have absolutely no knowledge of, and with any luck the museum will contain someone who knows all about it.
And then, of course, once you're back in London, you did continue to be involved in the school in different guises.
Yes, I became I became involved in the school. What was his name? Paul Wright, the ex-ambassador, who ran the Elizabethan Club, mm-hmm. and who I've met various places. And he said, would I be prepared to take over the... What was it? I think I was president rather than chairman, I can't remember, of the club. So I agreed to do that. And it was up to that time I'd had very little to do with the school since I left. And it was rather nice to come back to it and get involved in it again. From there I went on in due course to go on to the governing body. So, and of which I've just come up after, I think, 22 years, which is far too long.
What sort of... Well, first of all, I was going to ask, how did the school seem from that different perspective? Coming in as a governor and seeing sort of the behind the scenes?
I suppose... a lot of it was obviously familiar. What was unfamiliar was getting to know the headmasters and the senior teachers in a way that you simply don't as a pupil. Yes, seeing the general working and operation of the school, which was always interesting.
Did it seem a very different organisation from the one that you'd known as a pupil? I suppose big changes, girls coming,
yes,
the school growing.
I think it did seem different. Subsequently, in the 90s, I had two daughters at Westminster School, and although I knew that there had been girls there for some time at that point, it still came as sort of a shock to find I was a parent of two Westminster girls. They both enjoyed it enormously, and that was a change. A lot of the school had become, I think, more academic than it was in my day, and it was on the upward trajectory of getting endless entries to Oxbridge and so on, and so the academic side was perhaps more to the fore than it had been in my day. When I first became a governor, the occasionally controversial headmaster was John Ray, but I had known John before coming onto the governing board, because he was one of my trustees at the Imperial War Museum, having written a rather good book on conscientious objectors in the First World War, and so I knew him. That was which was nice. I always got on well with David Summerscale, a very nice man. Tristan was a bit more difficult, but. then Stephen also got on extremely well.
Was there a strong sense as the governor that the character of the headmaster shaped the direction of the school.
Yes, I, which I think is as it should be. If you were to ask someone like Michael Bourne what the governing body is there for, he will tell you very firmly that the only useful thing the governing body does is appoint the headmaster. And they're responsible for it, and if it's a mistake, it's there. And that is true, I suppose. But no, clearly there's more responsibilities than just that. But being involved in various appointments, as I was, is extremely interesting. My career, the various museums, I have interviewed endless people for endless jobs, and my overall feeling is that if you've done, you or committees involved have done their work properly, you get down to 5 or 6 people, any one of whom is more than capable of doing the job you're advertising, and almost sticking a pin into that list is the way you get the final one.
I think it's very difficult for those of us who, you know, aren't involved to have a sense of what that whole process must be like. You know, having read things like sort of C.P. Snow, you sort of have this very sort of dramatic depictions of those kind of elections. But
I didn't experience anything like that. I have to say, probably some relief. It's always an interesting process, and I'm quite a strong believer in first impressions. You know, the first time someone walks into a room and sits down, and if you think you don't like them from then on, that's probably not a bad judgment. Although it's not based on anything particularly.
And what was it like being a parent of children at the school?
Well, it was, as I say, slightly unsettling. So, they were both here under Tristram, I think they may have been, or first one may have been something, I can't remember. They both enjoyed it. By this stage, we were living in the centre of London, so they were both day pupils. As I say, they enjoyed it and did very well at the school.
You've mentioned, of course, that such a big responsibility of the governing body is appointing the headmaster. Have any of the other decisions that you've had to make sort of weighed heavily? Has it always been an enjoyable experience, or has it sometimes felt more of a burden?
There are less enjoyable ones, and I mean there comes a point when, particularly if people have to be disciplined and then possibly fired, it's never a pleasant activity, but has to be done from time to time.
I think so few people are really conscious of sort of all the work that governors put in, you know, entirely voluntarily.
Yes. That is true, and it, of course, it's tied up with the fact that I always think there should be more younger governors. But of course, if you're in your 30s or 40s, you're busy establishing your career and you haven't got time to devote. And it is important, clearly, as you say, for governors to be prepared to give time to the school. The start of my governorship was particularly interesting, which I read near the start. I was in the school for a meeting of, I don't remember what, and the headmaster, who must have been David Zomerskell, I suppose, asked me to stay behind because the agreement with the Disney Corporation had just come through, and some documents needed signing. And I and another governor, I can't remember who it was, both agreed to stay. And through the door came two very large American gentlemen, both carrying suitcases. And these were filled with documents. And we had to sign these. We had our lawyers, who I don't think were Farrers in those days there, but we kept being presented with documents signed there. And occasionally we'd say, is it to the lawyers, is it all right to sign this? And they would say, yes. We had no idea what we were signing. So, but in that sense, I am at least partially responsible for the poo money coming to the school.
Is there anything that you were expecting to say or would like to say about the school that I haven't given you an opportunity to say?
Is there anything? Well, the one thing perhaps we didn't touch on from the time I was at the school was the core, CCF, which you had to be part of. It was run with great efficiency and enthusiasm by Denny Brock, who had served in the war, and we were all issued with kit. Perhaps as a portent of my later work at the Imperial War Museum, we were issued with rifles, which I did a little quick research on and discovered that they were, I think, Martini Henrys of the dating back to the Boer War, so we wouldn't have been able to do much with them. And we had to appear every Friday afternoon, and we were marched around the yard and drilled, and it was one or two people sort of enjoyed it. Most people didn't. One extraordinary experience, however, was this was the period of the Cold War when there was a real threat of nuclear attack from Russia, and one term we were offered various alternatives which we could do. One was a course in civil defence, and I held my hand up and said I'd do civil defence, and it was taught by someone who came in, a wonderful man called Major Lusty. There used to be, I think probably long gone, a firm called Lusty's Turtle Soups, which was a family firm, I think, probably dating back to the 18th century when turtle soup was all the thing. Major Lusty taught us about civil defence, taking us on outings on Salisbury Plain and showing us how if we papered up all our windows with brown paper and then put a paper bag on our heads. This was a good way to avoid the worst of effects of radiation when the bomb had dropped. And the one I really remember is a field day on Salisbury Plain with the CCF, and Major Lusty came down with us and said the scenario is that the bomb has just dropped and you are one of the few people to survive. Now, what have we got to do? Of course, the first thing is, if you're going to survive, you've got to be able to eat. So, what are we going to do about eating? Well, most of you don't know, he said, that you can make a very serviceable oven out of a dustbin. And fortunately, in the carefully built, ruined building we were in, there was an absolutely pristine dustbin. And he said, I'll show you how you make an oven out of this dustbin, which he proceeded to do, and he then said, what are we going to cook in our dustbin? And he said, I know, we'll cook a lemon meringue pie, which we did, and it was very good, and it tasted excellent. But after that, my inevitable vision of the nuclear holocaust was eating lemon meringue pie on Salisbury Plain, which was perhaps as good as anything else. One or two people from the CCF did actually go off and do... Well, I'd just missed National Service by a few months. My brother had to do it. Again, luck taking part in a place in one's career. I missed National Service by a few months, and then when I went to teach in America, I got a visa which classified me as a permanent alien, which made me sound as though I came from Mars. But as a permanent alien, I... had no rights. I couldn't vote, or was not a citizen in any sense. But to my surprise, I had to register for the draft, and it was the middle of the Vietnam War. Someone told me I could wait for a year before registering, and I did wait for a year and then registered. And I got my draft card back. I think I've still got it somewhere, which said, you are classified 5A, turn over to see meaning of classification. And I turned over, and it said, 5A, too old for military service. And I'd just had my 25th birthday. So I wasn't, initially, I wasn't sure whether I was insulted or delighted by this. But certainly, one of my fellow who come at the same time, same age as me, to the States, actually was drafted and got on the first plane back home. But
Was there any kind of drilling at school in the event of a nuclear attack? Was this a bit early for sort of duck and cover and things like that?
No, I apart from the brown paper and paper bags, I think which we would have been expected to deploy, I think there was nothing else. The other thing which I didn't mention about school life, in those days, it may still exist, I hope it does. If you wore a scholar's gown, you were entitled to go into the Strangers' Gallery in Parliament. I did this, usually borrowing a scholar's gown, and I heard lots of interesting and exciting debates in there. If it does still exist, I hope people still do it, because it's certainly a good way to learn things, learn about political life and so on.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you very much for giving up your time.